From Arizona to Indiana, Kansas to Washington, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Federal Reserve confirmed interest rates will rise, and it was a volatile week on the equity markets. David Beckworth from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University joins us with analysis. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer has announced his retirement, giving President Biden the opportunity to name a replacement. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Fewer and fewer American workers are joining a labor union. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Chris Edwards from the Cato Institute about the impact. And the latest census data shows people continue to vote with their feet, moving from high-tax states to states with more economic opportunity. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The equity markets went on a wild ride this past week as investors awaited signals from the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee about interest rate hikes and an easing of stimulus. For details, we turn to David Beckworth. He is a former economist with the U.S. Treasury and now serves as a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. David, welcome to American Radio Journal. David, the Federal Open Market Committee, part of the Federal Reserve System, had their meeting this week. Tell us a bit about what it is they decided and any indication as to where they might be planning to go in the future.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve decided today to commit itself to interest rate hikes in the future. So it didn't lead to any interest rate changes presently, but they have signaled they're going to have 3 to 4 interest rate hikes over this year, so maybe every other meeting. So maybe by the end of the year, their target rate will be close to 1%. They also indicated, though, that they are going to start reducing the size of their balance sheet. So the Federal Reserve bought a bunch of assets up during the pandemic over the past 2 years, and they are slowly reversing that or winding that down. And they gave some details, some principles on how that will unfold. There's still a lot of uncertainty. We don't know how fast, how much, how small will the balance sheet get. The Fed's balance sheet right now is close to $9 trillion. Before the pandemic, it was about $4 trillion, and we thought that was large. So they have a long journey to go. So they got two things they got to work through. One, raising interest rates, which they have signaled and markets have priced in already. And two, reducing the size of their balance sheet. Now, they said the most important part of what they're doing is raising interest rates.
In terms of the fact that they have this large balance sheet, and the markets have been aware of that, and I think by any indicator, the markets have done extremely well over the last year or two, even despite COVID and all of the uncertainty there. But this past week, David, we saw a lot of volatility and the markets dropped significantly. How does all this affect that?
Well, that was a question raised to Chair Powell in the press conference following the announcement that the Fed made. And he said, look, we don't respond to those movements because, as you know, markets went down, they went up, they went down, went up, kind of like a yo-yo. He said they only respond to those to the extent it affects the real economy, only to the extent that it affects jobs, housing, things like that. So that's what they've said. But I think you maybe can make a link from what the Fed announced it's going to do to the volatility. So the Fed really announced back in December that it was going to have a series of rate hikes this year. So what we learned today was really just kind of a confirmation or reaffirmation of what they said in December. But what's interesting is they made the announcement. Of course, it's Jay Powell who comes out. He's the face of the Fed. He has a press conference. And when they made the announcement they could have 3 to 4 rate hikes back in December, it didn't really rattle markets. But then in early January, about I think it's January 5th, the minutes from the December meeting came out. And for some reason, the markets, when they read those minutes, it rattled them. And it's continued to rattle them. And what we saw last week, I think, is a continuation of it. So the best way I can wrap my mind around that is that it's like when your mom calls you from supper, when you're a little kid, you're upstairs or in your room somewhere. Time to go, you know, time to eat. And you don't respond, and then she starts yelling at you multiple times, and you panic, and you run down the stairs really fast. I think the markets maybe were a little complacent at first, and then when they read the minutes and they've read the tone of other Federal Reserve officials, they realized this is serious. Fed is really going to raise rates, and they begin to panic. And what we saw was a sell-off in tech stocks more than the other ones, and crypto too. It you know, tanked quite a bit this week. So it's had different effects, but I think the market is responding to the growing realization that the Fed will be tightening policy this year. The Fed was worried about full employment. It's now more worried about inflation. And so it's aggressively moving forward.
Talk a little bit about inflation, David. We have seen inflation in some months approaching or topping 7%. The markets, part of the skitterishness that we've seen in this last week or two, is inflation adding fuel to that fire as well?
Well, what's interesting, if you look at the bond market, particularly the Treasury bond market, you can infer what they expect to happen to inflation over the next year or two, and even beyond that. But it's useful to look what do they forecast is going to happen. And it's useful because people who trade bonds, so think of someone who buys a 5-year government bond, that's a fixed income asset. It pays you a fixed amount of money or income every period. So when you buy that, you got to think, okay, is inflation going to go up, go down? Because it affects the purchasing power of the payment you get from it. And so these are folks who have skin in the game. They trade these bonds. And what they are actually forecasting is that inflation will come down in the future. It's actually going to decrease. So at least the bond market is expecting inflation to go down in the future, even though it may remain elevated to the first half of this year. Most professional forecasters, the market signals, Fed officials themselves, they all expect inflation to kind of begin to go down the second half of the year. I think then the inflation really only mattered to the market volatility this past week and before that, only to the extent it meant the Fed was going to have to tighten its policy faster and sooner.
The fact that the Fed is going to begin reducing its portfolio, wouldn't you normally think, and of course sometimes how you might logically think is not how markets think, but wouldn't you normally look at it and say, well, if the Fed is taking this action, that means the economy is recovering from the pandemic. Wouldn't that normally be considered a plus rather than a negative for the markets?
Yes, and in fact, there are good theories out there that say it shouldn't really matter at all. In fact, it needs to be done. One, you know, to the extent the Fed's balance sheet adds stimulus or support to the economy, you do want to pull it out. You want to kind of take your foot off the gas. You know, you're maybe lightly tapping the brakes. You're not bringing the whole economy to a stop. You're just taking off some of the gas, some of the force, and that's natural. But there's even other arguments that say that outside of like intense crisis, so outside of March 2020 when markets were literally imploding, or say 2008, when the Fed buys up a bunch of assets, it really doesn't have a huge effect other than a signal that it sends that they're serious about stuff. So there's one school of thought that says, look, the Fed's balance sheet really shouldn't have that much of a difference on the economy. But I think where it does, and what we've seen, is the signal. It freaked out people in the market, but I don't foresee it. My own view is I don't foresee it having any real impact on the growth of the economy this year.
We have been talking with David Beckworth, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. David, before we go, tell us a little bit about Mercatus and where can folks go to read your writings and the research of the Mercatus Center online?
Well, thank you for having me. The Mercatus Center is a research center that attempts to bridge the gap between academic studies and real policy world ideas. So it bridges the gap between academics and the policymakers. You can follow me at David Beckworth, one continuous word, at Twitter. So at David Beckworth. And you can go to Mercatus.com for material there as well.
David Beckworth of the Mercatus Center. David, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, a major development this week as we have a retirement from the Supreme Court of the United States. We're going to talk about that today. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks.
Justice Stephen Breyer, one of the three reliably left-wing, progressive, quote-quote, justices of the court, is retiring. Scott, some thought that maybe he was given a nudge off the bench by the White House?
Yeah, well, apparently Breyer told the White House that he would be making an announcement about his retirement at some point last week, And this week, what we saw was the White House leaking that information ahead of any official announcement from the Supreme Court. Obviously, that pretty much upset the Associate Justice. And so what we have here is really epic battle once again for the future of the court. It's a lifetime appointment. On one hand, we've seen Democrats talking about reforming the Supreme Court so that they can pack the number of justices. Hopefully, this opening tempers the motivation for them to completely destroy the Supreme Court and instead focus on the confirmation of one justice. But we obviously hope that that's a justice that will have strict adherence to the Constitution and the role of the judiciary.
Well, clearly the White House wanting this confirmation to take place now before the November elections and the possible loss of control of the Senate in 2023 here, Scott. But the president, Joe Biden, when he was campaigning, promised that he would appoint an African-American woman to the position. So is that what we can expect to see happen?
That's exactly what the White House says that they plan to do. They plan to fulfill that campaign pledge that was made even before he announced that Kamala Harris would be his running mate. And so there's several folks on the short list right now that are kind of being buzzed about. And you have really influential members of Congress like Jim Clyburn, who's in the Democratic leadership in the House, really pushing for Biden to fulfill that pledge. So we would have full expectation that the nominee would be consistent with that pledge from Biden. And what I kind of think about is in the Trump administration, his three nominees to the Supreme Court were vehemently opposed by the radical left. And typically, Republicans have not put up the similar fight against Biden's nominations. So far, underneath the Biden administration, judicial nominations and executive branch nominations are being confirmed at a much higher rate than they were being confirmed underneath the Trump administration. So you're seeing a lot of bipartisanship in the Senate for these nominees. I would actually expect several of the Senate Republicans to vote yes on a nomination unless the Republican leadership and the ranker on the Judiciary Committee are able to discover real red flags that will slow down a nomination or prevent it from being confirmed.
The bottom line here, though, Scott, is since Justice Breyer was already one of the pillars of the progressive wing or the left wing of the court, his replacement, regardless of who it is not really going to change the balance of the court all that much.
Yeah, that's a great point. We obviously have seen some major decisions from the Supreme Court over the past year that have resulted with Alito and Thomas on one end and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on another side or Amy Coney Barrett on another side. And the so-called conservative majority on the Supreme Court, I think, has done a good job overall of interpreting the law. And at times that's been in contrast with the conservative activists that do want to see the court moving forward with, protecting specific rights.
Already we hear a number of leading voices in the Democrat Party saying the new nominee has to be somebody who's going to pursue certain policies. Talk for just a brief minute here, Scott, about the role of the court. The role of the court isn't to make policy, is it?
No, it should be to interpret the law in a fashion that is consistent with the Constitution. And so that's why typically conservatives want to see somebody that has strict adherence, a strict constitutionalist, and an originalist be the nominee. Now, the Democrats have clearly used political motivations when it comes to the Supreme Court to achieve many of their agenda items through a liberal message. The way that I would sort of look at this process now is that, you have a House and Senate. They have basically turned into a lame duck majority for Joe Biden in the first year. The Build Back Better Act is effectively dead. Voting rights legislation, they didn't abolish the legislative filibuster to get that through. So the Biden agenda is largely at a crossroads, and there will be a lot of people that say, well, we got to get the right liberal on the court to advance our policies then. That is not the role of the judiciary. We need to make sure that the Constitution's protected and that we get the right associate justice to fill that spot for Justice Breyer.
In terms of process, what can we expect to see unfold now?
Well, the first thing will be sort of the political arm pulling that you'll see from leading activists, especially in the African-American community, because the Biden administration has promised that this will be a black justice. So I would really look for some of that political jockeying to occur. Then we'll see a nomination, probably the White House is indicating in about 30 days. After that, they'll schedule meetings with all the senators on the committee, for sure, from both sides of the aisle. And then after that, they'll schedule a committee hearing, and ultimately they'll bring the nomination to the Senate floor for confirmation.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure. The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We're united in this idea of economic freedom and liberty and opportunity. And if people want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is @ClubForGrowth.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Membership in labor unions continues to decline, and that will have an impact on both policy and politics. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns why from Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute.
We hear a lot in politics and specifically a lot from the Biden administration about union jobs. You know, good union jobs is a thing that President Biden likes to say when he talks about his transportation package or the Build Back Better plan or really just about anything that his administration does. And we have this idea, I think, this sort of story in our minds about union jobs being people who are building things, blue collar workers making things. And that's just not actually the reality anymore. And that's what we're going to take a closer look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Chris Edwards. He's the director of tax policy studies and the editor of downsizinggovernment.org. He works at the Cato Institute, and he is a regular here on the show. We've had him on several times before. We welcome him back now. Chris, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Hey, thanks a lot, Eric.
Actually, I wanted to have you on, Chris, to talk about a post that you've just written that's up at Cato's blog right now. People can find this at cato.org. And it's Americans Mainly Reject Labor Unions is the title here. And it's looking at some new data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Every year, the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out information on how many Americans work in union jobs. And I think, or are members of unions, I should say. And I think these numbers would surprise a lot of people who probably think 30, 40, maybe 60% of the workforce is unionized. Not even close.
Not even close. The share of the U.S. private sector that is unionized has been plunging ever since the 1950s. Just since 1965, we have really good data. The share of the private sector that is unionized has fallen from over 30% to just 6% today. And the new data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that in 2021, the union share in the private sector fell a bit more. That contrasts really sharply with state and local governments, where we have something like 16 million workers, you know, teachers, police officers, et cetera. State and local governments are highly unionized. Just quickly, the state government unionization rate is about 30%, and the local government unionization rate is about 40%, and those unionization rates have been static. So unions are deeply entrenched in governments, but in the private sector, workers have rejected unions, and only 6% of the private workforce is unionized.
So when we hear politicians, Joe Biden, let's say, for example, talk about union jobs, talk about unionized workers, I think he wants you to think of the guy at the car plant. Most of those jobs are no longer union jobs, by the way. I mean, really what he's talking about is he's talking about government jobs, he's talking about bureaucrats and teachers.
President Biden has a really bizarre, antiquated view of the American economy. I guess it's because he grew up in the 50s and 60s, and he's been in government for, I don't know, 50 years or so now. He had this really old-fashioned view of the American economy. If you look at some of his speeches and his economic plans, he mentions union jobs dozens and dozens of times. It's really bizarre, given that 94% of Americans in the private sector don't work in unionized jobs, and workers themselves have rejected unions. They've moved to companies where they don't have to join unions. They're not forced to join unions. I mean, unions to organize a workplace, they only need 51% of the vote of workers in a workplace. And over, American workers themselves have rejected unions when labor unions have tried to organize workplaces. So Biden's view of the economy is really anachronistic.
We're talking with Chris Edwards. He's the director of tax policy studies at the Cato Institute. You can check out his work there at cato.org, including this latest piece crunching the numbers on union membership rates, and obviously much higher union membership rates, as you were just saying, Chris, in state and local governments than in the private sector. Only 6% of American private sector workers are members of unions. Now, I want to finish on this because I think there's probably a line of thought out there from the left that says, well, it's not Americans that are rejecting labor unions. It's that, like, big corporations have smashed unions and now they're exploiting workers, and we need to get that unionization rate higher. They just sort of respond to that argument here, because that's not really the case, but we definitely hear that line of argument from people like Elizabeth Warren on the left, who want to see more private sector workers be unionized, even though they're choosing not to be.
Look, I'm all for if American workers want to join voluntary associations, like teachers, for example, used to be in voluntary associations, I think that's great. But what American workers have rejected is this forced top-down mandatory unionization, which is called collective bargaining. So if you have a workplace where just a bare majority of 51% want to join a labor union, they force and impose that labor union on the other 49% who wanted nothing to do with it, which in my view is a violation of their free association and free speech rights. Over and over again, when unions push and get elections in workplaces, Americans have rejected labor unions, and that's why the rate has fallen from over 30% to just 6% today.
Yeah, and we saw that most recently at that Amazon player most, I guess, the most public example of that recently at that Amazon plant in Alabama, where workers there overwhelmingly rejected joining the union, even though everybody on the left wanted to point to that election as if it was some sort of big blow against Amazon. I think it ended up being close to 3-1 a vote against joining the union. And that's the case everywhere. As this data bears out, again, only about 6% of American private sector workers are members of unions. That compares to about 30% in state governments and over 40% in local governments. Chris Edwards from the Cato Institute, thanks for joining us and breaking it all down today.
Thanks a lot, Eric.
And again, that is Chris Edwards. He is the director of tax policy studies at the Cato Institute. Check out his work online at cato.org. Check out our coverage of everything going on here in Washington, D.C. and around the country at reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
High tax states like California and New York continue to lose population to pro-growth states, including Texas and Florida. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council looks at the latest census numbers on this American Radio Journal commentary.
President Joe Biden loves to use the phrase, America is on the move, when talking about the state of the American economy. And he's right, at least in one sense. America is on the move, or rather, her people are on the move. And let me explain. As the new 2021 estimates from the United States Census Bureau now online, Americans continue to move or vote with their feet to states that have lower tax burdens, value economic competitiveness, and have implemented less stringent or no lockdowns during the COVID-19 pandemic. As we at ALEC have pointed out for many years, there is an abundance of research supporting the idea that taxes and the quest for more economic opportunity are the significant drivers in many cases of migration across states. As expected, Texas, which ranked number 15 in our annual Rich States, Poor States report of free market economies, is the big winner of the 2020 census. The Lone Star State was the only state in America to gain more than one congressional seat. According to the recent 2021 Census Bureau estimates on migration during the pandemic, Texas saw its population grow by a whopping 310,000 new residents. Florida, which ranked number 2 in our Rich States, Poor States Economic Outlook ranking, also gained a congressional seat. And during the pandemic, Florida's population grew by more than 200,000 new residents. Meanwhile, the largest percentage increases were in free market states like Idaho, which gained nearly 3% growth in the last year, Utah with nearly 2% growth, as well as Montana with nearly 2% growth, all free market states. And perhaps not coincidentally, Utah has ranked number 1 in our Rich States, Poor States Economic Outlook ranking for all 14 editions of our report and led the nation over the last decade with 18.4% population growth. Really an incredible free market success story. Texas and Florida remain great examples of how avoiding a personal income tax and having a free market policy environment has significantly boosted economic development efforts in those states, attracting taxpayers and job creators from high-tax states. Both states have no personal income tax, a huge factor for economic growth. And Governor Greg Abbott and Ron DeSantis in Florida and Texas have committed to keeping their respective states' economies open during the pandemic. While some will discount the moves into Texas and Florida as simply a function of mild winter weather, Americans aren't simply on a quest to escape the snow and the ice. A new study from United Van Lines found, for instance, that 69% of moves in South Dakota were inbound from other states in the last year. South Dakota is an incredibly beautiful state, but it's unlikely that taxpayers are moving there for their winter weather. It's more likely because South Dakota's commitment to pro-growth economic policies. South Dakota ranked number 10 in our Rich States, Poor States Economic Outlook ranking, in part because it is one of only two states in America that do without both a personal and a business income tax. In addition, Governor Kristi Noem in South Dakota kept her state open during the pandemic. That is one of the many reasons why Governor Noem ranked number one with the top ranking in the 2021 Laffer-Alec Report on America's Governors. So where are these Americans moving from? They're fleeing high-tax, anti-growth, lockdown states like California and New York, which both ranked in the bottom tier of rich states, poor states, New York ranking 50th out of 50. For the first time in state history, going all the way back to 1850, California will lose its first congressional seat. California continues suffering a mass exodus due to taxpayers voting with their feet across state lines. This phenomenon is also true in New York, where that state has lost nearly 20 congressional seats over the last 60 or 70 years. Californians and New Yorkers are leaving behind high taxes, unaffordable cost of living levels, and draconian government lockdowns. And I believe these trends will continue, especially as employers have offered their employees unprecedented levels of work flexibility during the pandemic. The remote workforce is growing, and I think it's here to stay. Americans continue to vote with their feet in response to uncompetitive economic policies in states. The migration of taxpayers from California and New York and high-tax states to states like Texas, Florida, South Dakota, Utah, and others is economic theory coming true. The gains these states have achieved can be attributed to their longstanding commitment to pro-growth economic policies. Residents of big government states see better futures for themselves and their families in states where taxes are low, government spending is under control, and government doesn't try to micromanage the private sector. Limited government, free market states will continue to see an influx of residents seeking to live where freedom is maximized. Folks, freedom works, and our 50 states show us this phenomenon every single year. For more information on this and more, please visit alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WWOS-FM in Orangeburg, South Carolina, WJAS-AM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, along with WFYL-AM in Jeffersonville, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.